Donald in the Kitchen talks about food. Donald in the Kitchen talks recipes. Donald in the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on Community Radio. Welcome to the Donald in the Kitchen. My name is Lana Nuchtigal.
And I'm Donna Prusquintas.
We gather here once a week at the studios of KHOY Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames in the midst of the United States, in the midst of all the good things.
The middle of the middle.
Well, we are the middle. We're right here in the middle, and we gather here to talk about food, farming advice, recipes, and opinions. We get around to a little bit of everything, and we get by with a little help from our friends.
Oh, yes. The Donald in the Kitchen Show is sponsored in part by the Mucky Duck Pub, where pub means community. For more information, go to themuckyduckpub.com or call the pub and ask for Marcus, or just stop in and imbibe or have a lovely dinner.
Yeah, very good. Very good. So thanks to Marcus and the Muckduck folk, and thanks to all of you who support Community Radio. Around our kitchen table, we talk about a lot of things, and today we're going to get to a recipe, and Donna's got a movie review and a book review.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And we're going to talk to Mark Rasmussen, who talked to us quite a few years ago, but this we thought we would share this again. He's going to talk to us about what cows eat, which I think everyone needs
to
know.
What is he, a microbiologist? What, I forgot.
I think it is. He tells us
he
later.
Does, and, yeah. And he's the director of the Leopold Center.
Yes, he is. So there we go. Anyway, recipe. I actually got together and baked something once. I have to do that every now and then.
Oh, Lana, you're such a good baker.
And I love to bake. So the recipe sort of tweaked my fancy because they're called back-to-school raspberry bars because it's that time of year, back to school.
And raspberry season.
And it is raspberry season. I got this from a book that I got for Christmas. Food 52 is the name of the organization, and they put out a book called Genius Desserts, 100 Recipes That Will Change the Way You Bake, and it's from 10 Speed Press. The recipe is from Karen DeMasco. The book has all kinds of different recipes from different people, and this one appealed to me because, one thing, it was easy, and it had that special little phrase in there that said, you can kind of alter the ingredients if you want. Use up what you got. So I like
that.
Yeah,
they don't always let you do that in baking.
Right, right. These are, and because it's raspberry season, okay, it's a bar. It's a bar. And it has a bit more butter ratio, butter than a normal bar would have. And it's got a little bit of flour in it. It's got kind of a granola sort of feeling to it. And it's got made with jelly in the middle. I've been doing lots of jelly. So I had jelly. And one of the little footnotes in this recipe said, well, you can follow the recipe that is written here, but if you have any jelly left over in the refrigerator, you can kind of, you know, kind of use
that. And don't we all?
And don't we? Little bits and pieces. Okay, here's the ingredients. 1 cup pecans or other nuts, coarsely chopped. 1 1/2 cup flour. 1 1/4 cup old-fashioned rolled oats. 1/3 cup sugar. 1/3 cup dark brown sugar. Densely packed or firmly packed. 1 teaspoon salt. 1/2 teaspoon baking soda. 1/3 cup butter melted and cooled. And 1 cup raspberry jam. Or whatever you have. I happen to have some. I've been making jelly, so you know that you never fill the last jar all the way. So I had a couple of those jars. I kind of mixed those all together, and I do have a lot of fresh raspberries. So I just put some fresh raspberries in it. Okay, you toast the pecans, and then cool them and
in the oven,
and heat the oven to 350 degrees. Butter an 8-inch square pan and line with parchment paper, and leave some paper hanging over the edge for easier lifting when bars are done. Now I wouldn't have done that before, but boy does that ever help. Mm-hmm. And butter the parchment, and then you whisk together all the dry ingredients, and you put 2/3 and add the butter. Press 2/3 of the flour oat mixture in a baking pan. Spread the jam on this. Don't take it all the way out to the edge because it will kind of melt and ooze. So leave a little space. And then And then bake for about 40 minutes. Rotate the pan halfway through baking. And let the bars cool on a rack. This time seems excessive. It says about 3 hours, but you kind of need that jelly to reform itself.
I mean, because they're while they're beautiful and delicious, they are quite crumbly.
They are. So, and then you can use that parchment to lift it out, cut into squares, and store in an airtight container at room temperature. Back to school raspberry bars.
Oh, they are so yummy. It's almost like apple crispish.
Yeah,
it is. You know,
it is, but it's a little firmer.
But not as goopy. Right. And you actually can eat them by, you know, you can put them in your hand and eat them at the risk of dribbling oatmeal down your shirt. I mean, the oats, not the oatmeal.
Mm-hmm.
Another little tip I was going to, when you have to chop the nuts, like if I have a, you know, you buy the pecans in a bag and I just take a kind of either a jar that's full of something or something heavy and just smash them while they're in the bag so that you don't have to chop them.
That's a good idea.
Put them in a, you know, a Ziploc bag and, you know, you don't want to smash so heavily that you break the bag. Because you also don't want the nuts to go to smithereens. But, you know, smash one side, flip it over, smash the other side.
Good enough. And that goes really well in here. So there we go. Back to school
they
raspberry
are delicious,
bars.
Lana. Thank you for the treat.
And I will put this, I will send this to our web coordinator.
Oh, it's going to be posted.
And I will put it on the Donna Lana Kitchen website. Thanks to Gio for doing that.
Well, I want to say something about Food 52, which is the kind of the organization that this book, Genius Desserts, comes from. It is a website where they try to sell you lots of very fancy, expensive culinary things. But they also have good recipes. I think it was founded by a writer for the New York Times recipe section. So they know what they're doing. You can trust their recipes. They're fairly straightforward. And it is a good resource for recipes.
Good. That's so.
And we like their books.
Yeah, look up Food 52. All right. So we have a movie review. There is something all the rage, and Donna is right on it. Go for it, Donna. What do you have to share with us?
Well, I have to admit, I'm a Downton Abbey fan. I watched all of them the whole way. Well, I can't stand this episodic thing, you know, where you have to wait. So I would wait till the end of the season. Then I would binge watch the whole how many ever hours all night long.
I couldn't do that. I like to watch every week, but okay.
But anyway, you know, we're fans, especially because it often shows a lot of historical kitchen stuff. I love the downstairs things. I feel like, well, the upstairs was fun. The characters are interesting. But, you know, the upstairs kind of manners and morals, a lot of that is still applicable. The things in the kitchen have changed dramatically. And all the camera work and the kitchen equipment and the, you know, the big ovens and how they made this and that, it's all fascinating to me. And so I'm pleased to announce that there is now the official Downton Abbey cookbook.
Mm.
And it's by Annie Gray, who was a culinary historian who worked through a lot of the stuff for the television show. And I went to see the movie last night, and I bought the cookbook. Now, I am not recommending that you run out and buy this cookbook. It's just, for me, the culinary curiosities in it were worth it. But, you know, I mean, it has a lot of things like trifles and very heavy cakes. And it's got the upstairs section. It talks about breakfast with actually a really good recipe for kedgeree, which I will probably never make. But it was something that it's basically a rice with flaked fish in it and then some eggs stirred in.
For breakfast?
Yeah. Heavy breakfasts. And then lunch and supper and then afternoon teas, the Dundee cake, the pineapple walnut cake, the Madeira cake. Then there's a whole thing on picnics, shoots, and race meets where you have potted cheese, ham and veal pie, many ways with sandwich fillings.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Then festive foods, and then the upstairs dinners. Soups, cucumber soup, consomme, Palestine soup. And then there's the fish course, the entrees, the vegetables, the sweets. And then there's a whole section on like digestives and ices and things that come between the then there's the downstairs food. And then there's a whole chapter on something called the still room, which was probably where they originally did a lot of their fermenting, their jam making, their household cleaning concoctions. I mean, you have to realize they didn't run out and buy dish soap or even silver polish or, you know, it is kind of fascinating from a historical point of view. I'm not sure that I'll probably cook anything from here, but it's a beautiful book with lots of pictures, of course, and lots of kind of fun if you're a Downton Abbey fan. Now, about the movie, okay. The funny thing is the movie has done very well at the box office. It even outsold the new Brad Pitt movie, which is heavily publicized. So everybody is shocked that more people went to see Downton Abbey than Ed Astra. But I have to say, that movie was not. I'm not going to discourage anyone from going to see it, because if you love Downton Abbey, it's one more chance to see it. But, you know, film, which only gives you 2 hours, doesn't really allow for the kind of nuances that hours and hours and hours of television have. And although all the characters are there that you love, it's kind of like I turned to the people I went to the movie. I said, this is like Disneyland for adults. It's everything, and everything ended happily ever after. And I felt like, you know, when you see a beautiful cake and you think, oh, doesn't that look fabulous? And you want to eat it, and then you bite into it and it's just super, super sweet with very little flavor. So the movie was like that. The visuals were brilliant, but the dialogue was like so saccharine.
Oh,
so
really?
Even the vial at the grandmother said the most predictable things when she's usually the funniest, sharpest.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was disappointing in that way.
Oh.
But nevertheless, it's worth seeing if you're a Downton Abbey fan.
Yeah.
So go while it's in Ames. You know, it was fun. And the cookbook is fun, too. And if I ever cook anything from it, we'll talk about it on air.
Yeah, the idea of that age at the turn of the...
Well, culinary history is fascinating. Yeah. How did we get to where we are from where we came? Some of it is the same as my grandmother did and probably her grandmother did. Mm-hmm. And some of it is very, very different.
Yeah. I mean, we still beat eggs and make cakes and everything. But most of us do not have staff.
No. and another reason it's interesting to me, because for years when I was a private chef, I was the staff.
You were staff.
I was the staff. So and I have to say, I enjoyed my work immensely. You know, getting to do lots of fancy dinners with, you know, multiple courses. And when we had a lot of people for dinner, I did have help. Of course, you can't serve 80 people by yourself. So a lot of the protocol from Downton Abbey was, you know, it's still in place when you're having a rather grand dinner. And the clients that I had in Los Angeles were pretty sophisticated. After all, they were wealthy enough and had traveled enough that they had eaten many, many fine restaurants and food from all over the world. So, you know, it kept me on my toes, and I really enjoyed it, and it is tremendously creative. So I love watching Downton Abbey, and I certainly identify with Mrs. Patmore, and I want one of her aprons, or two or three, as a matter of fact, right? And I could even do with a hat if I had to. You know,
That's true.
It's fun. Really fun.
It is.
History is good. We got to know where we all came from and how we got to where we are. It might help to know where we're going.
That's true.
You never know.
That's true. Downton Abbey. Good for us. I want to mention that I was doing something this morning before I came to the studio. I was cutting up hot peppers and putting them in my food dryer. That works well. I don't just chopped up hot peppers.
And you didn't touch your eyes, did you?
I wish to report that I used really great gloves. And this year, I got through that process. Mm-hmm. Actually, I've done it twice now this year. And so use those gloves for those hot peppers because,
you can't.
It lasts
forever. The other trick, if you're only doing one, is to do it under cold running water.
Oh, really?
Well, like if you want to seed a jalapeno and you don't bother to put your gloves on, at least do it, with the faucet running. That will carry some of it away. And then, of course, don't touch your eyes afterwards.
Practice kitchen safety out there. This is KHOI, and this is Tasty Radio for the Heart of Iowa. Welcome back. This is the Donalana Kitchen. That was a couple jigs. The first one was called the Blackberry Quadrille. Speaking of jellies to make your back-to-school bars with, blackberries are good, too. Blackberry Quadrille. Often we dive back into our archives, and I was kind of, I don't know, does one surf the archives? I was doing that. Oh.
Because sometimes it bears repeating.
It does. It does. In August of 2015, way back when, we talked to Mark Rasmussen, and he is a microbiologist. So we get all kinds of people here in the kitchen, around our kitchen table, and he talked to us about cows and
the microbiome of the mini stomachs of cows.
And it is fascinating. Now, you wouldn't think, but it is. So let's go to this audio from a archive from the Donalana Kitchen to find out what cows eat. On this show, we talk about what's cooking in Central Iowa, and we are what we eat.
Today, our guest is Dr. Mark Rasmussen, who is the director of the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture. He is also a microbiologist, as he says. What did you say, Mark?
As opposed to a large biologist.
A microbiologist.
We tend to think small.
Okay, and we're talking with Mark today. Mark is here to talk about the microbiome. You want to give us a definition of that word?
Yeah, the microbiome is a big picture view of the microbes that we live with on our body, in our body, and people are looking at this in all kinds of habitats, all kinds of animals, soil, forests. Now with new sequencing technology, we can take these big picture views that we used to didn't have the techniques to do that.
I wonder why, because you see the word, the phrase microbiome, it's almost everywhere, and I was thinking of the human microbiome. And is so it's actually the microbiome is bigger than the just in the intestinal flora and fauna that we've been talking about for years.
Oh, yeah. That would be considered to be the gut microbiome or some term like
oh,
that.
Oh, a
but microbiome can be in the ocean. It can, you know, it can be in many different habitats.
So you are interested in gut microbiome.
Yeah, that's where I've spent most of my time the last 30 years or so in research and science. Yeah.
So he'd written this article. It's called Greening Up What We Eat. Basically, I'm going to just summarize it. It struck me as he's writing about cows here, but it struck me as a further admonition. And you do say this of eat your vegetables.
That's how I end the article, yeah.
Right.
As Grandma used to tell me, you know?
Exactly. And why, with all this new science, Mark, why should we eat our vegetables?
Well, it's, you know, in addition to the nutritional and fiber content that we've learned about, you know, some time
ago. Roughage.
Yeah, well,
I mean, that's
it has its limits. I mean, you know, all kale all the time is probably not what you want, but, you know.
I don't know, there are people who swear by that as their medicine, you know.
But we're learning other benefits of a diversified diet, basically, in animals and in humans, too.
Well, you talk here about that cattle are fed a standardized and simplified rations. And so what is that, and then what happens to them?
Well, there what I'm referring to is the cattle in their final feedlot stage, you know, 120 days or 140 mm-hmm. days, something like that, where...
And they've been on usually on pasture before that, or on grass anyway.
Yeah, I mean, basically in talking to some other folks that know ranching and animal science, our cattle system, even with our feedlot system, about 70% of the process is still forages and hay and roughage, things like that, because the brood cows are out there all the time mm-hmm. on forages of some type, you know, winter, summer grazing. And the calves are for the first part of their life when they're first born and then when they're weaned and they're still on pasture during that first summer. And it's only later when we bring them into the feedlot to speed up their growth by feeding corn. And
that's the last, how long in a sort of an average beef cow?
Oh, typically 120 days, maybe a little longer, mm-hmm. 140.
That's the fatten them up period, right?
Well, it does several things. I mean, one, yeah, it's a fact of biology that starch is easier to digest and ferment than cellulose. Mm-hmm. That's the fundamental restraint that we can't seem to get cattle to grow faster on forages than we can on corn because of that difference in those two molecules.
Plus, they're not running around burning off calories either.
Well, yeah, and that's part of the reason why we put animals in confinement of some sort is that, yeah, you're not burning that energy in a lot of movement.
So this
either.
Is kind of like couch potatoes, right?
Yeah,
you confine
yeah,
and eat high starches, right? And you gain weight.
They just don't have a TV in front of them, you know, with cable.
What would they watch? Bonanza, perhaps? I don't know. That's the segue. Back to the topic.
So, yeah, I mean, and the other thing is that the American consumer has gotten used to white fat on their meat.
And well
grass-fed, grass-fed cattle have a more yellowish appearance to, and of course, most people, if they'd see that in a package at the grocery store, they'd go, ooh, what's wrong with that piece of meat? You know, is it aged or has it been on the shelf too long or whatever?
No, it has higher ratios of which kind of fatty acids?
Well, it's various compounds in the forage material, carotenes that give their fat soluble, and so they end up in the fat. And so
fat is actually much healthier for you, isn't it?
Oh, but the perception is that when people look at it, they see it as an age indicator or a shelf life indicator. And so we're very used to having this bright white fat in our meat case. And so that would take a big education effort to get people past that, you know, skepticism of how long has that meat been sitting there?
I must say that it's something we've unlearned in the last I mean, all cattle used to be fed more or less on grass a long time ago, so we were used to that, and then we learned to like the white.
Well, you know, cattle have been fed corn in various amounts for over a century. I have a book that is about the history of cattle feeding in Illinois and Iowa back in the 18, you know, Civil War era. And at the time, you know, Illinois was a cattle.
Dairy?
No, this was beef.
Beef. Oh,
And there were big moguls in that day, too, that had, you know, banking connections in Chicago and downstate Illinois.
This is how they would have the West was one for cattle ranchers, basically.
Who?
The West.
Oh, yeah. Well, and that came
Range
along
Wars.
A little later.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, Illinois, believe it or not, was a cattle feeding state at one time. You know, you don't find many cattle in the state other than southern Illinois now, but the northern two-thirds. And at that time,
was that because of the railroad in Chicago? They could just ship it east?
Well, originally, feeding livestock was a way to transport your grain. You fed it to cattle or hogs, and then you walked them to Chicago before there were good roads, good railroads, you know, way back at the beginning.
And the other use for your corn was moonshine. Another value-added product.
Yeah, yeah. Well, in different parts of our history, it has kind of ebbed and, you know, flowed with history.
So what should they feed these cattle in Illinois when you walk them to Chicago?
Well, oftentimes I think, you know, they didn't necessarily even shell it. They just fed it as ear corn. And it's kind of interesting to see a brood cow, for example, eat an ear corn. I can remember on my grandpa's farm, I'd go up there as a kid, and we'd take these ears of corn and snap them over the edge of the feed bunk, which would pop them in two, you know, or in thirds or something. And then a cow would pick that up, and they just kind of roll it around in their mouth and shell the kernels off of the cob, you know.
And then spit the cob out?
Well, some, or they'd chew up the cob, too. But, you know, they'd
like
just be their
bone.
Own sheller, you know, and shell the kernels off. And so, yeah, corn has been fed to cattle for a long time. It's just that it, you know, it was in the, well, you probably remember the phrase Iowa corn-fed beef and baby beef. Back in the 50s and 60s, we had much shorter, smaller stature animals. But that was a marketing term at the time when Iowa was big into the cattle feeding era.
Before but then, we got into the pig feeding era.
Well, what happened was the packing plants moved out of Chicago. The stockyards began to close down in Omaha and Kansas City and Chicago. And also there was a move to get the cattle out of the mud. So they moved to the plain states. And along with that came irrigation technology out west, too, because you can't grow corn in western Kansas very well without added water. But it provided for better conditions for the cattle in terms of they weren't, you know, in March was always February, it was still frozen, but March, April could be really muddy seasons in terms of feed yards. And so cattle just did better when you put them in a drier climate.
And is that when we moved towards pork in Iowa then?
Well, Iowa's always been big in pork. You know, we have the same number of hogs or more now than we used to, but they're on fewer properties.
Yes, used we've to be noticed.
Yeah, they're more concentrated.
So now, at the time when they were feeding corn, were they also feeding soy?
cattle have been fed different protein sources over the years, depending on pricing. Cottonseed cake was a popular one to feed cows in the winter. So in other words, they'd take the cotton off for fabric production, but then you'd have these seeds.
And they're oily, too, aren't they?
Well, they're oily, but they have protein in them, and they do have some. They have a compound called gossypol, and we can't tolerate very much of it. Cattle can tolerate a larger dose of that, and so they
Sorry,
can...
Sorry, tolerate does not sound good to me.
Well, because...
I mean, they can eat this, something, and at best it doesn't make them sick.
That's what's so great about ruminants is they can tolerate plant toxins, natural plant toxins to degrees that we cannot, because they have this whole big fermentation vat called the rumen up front.
And how many stomachs do they have?
Well, it's called four. They have the reticulum, the rumen, the abomasum, and the omasum. And each have a different function. But the rumen is by far the largest. You know, it can be 50 gallons or something.
So their large microbiome in the intestines and digestive tract must be fairly interesting.
Oh, it is. I mean, I spent many, many years, you know, pulling microbes out of this environment and trying to figure out what they do.
Did you ever see one of those cows where they took the side out and put the window in?
Yep. We had some of those. Those are called fistulated animals.
Fistulated animals.
We learned this from, actually, physicians first learned this from gunshot wounds. Some people would have a wound to their stomach or their intestine, and it wouldn't heal up properly, so they'd have this opening. And so innovative physicians were trying to learn about the digestive process. So they would hang little pieces of meat on string or something in somebody's stomach and watch how fast it would disappear, you know, and things like that.
This is
getting into the strange realm.
Well, and this is happening at noon. So just kind of, you know, this is important science stuff. Sorry about that, folks. Oh, that's really interesting, though. I mean, just think of everything that's going on inside of us. And how cows work is always really, really interesting because they can convert, like you said, roughage, grass, carbon stuff.
Turn grass into milk. Now, that sounds like a miracle to me.
A miracle. Yeah. And they're big animals. Big animals.
But yet there are ruminant species in Africa that are very small, maybe only a foot tall. Ruminants are very versatile. I mean, you've got very small ones that live in forests and live mostly on fruits. So they live on a very rich diet of sugars and things like that in fruit. And then you've got the browsers, which are deer or giraffe, which live on leaves from brush and shrubs and trees.
How many stomachs do they have?
These are all the same. They all have the basic four. Although it's pretty simplified in the fruit eaters because it doesn't take as elaborate a system.
No, let's go through really fast, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then at the far extreme, you've got water buffalo that eat a very coarse forage diet, even more so than bison and cattle, which are kind of in the middle as grass grazers. So you've got this whole continuum and extreme examples.
So your research that you write about in this paper talks about how you feed the least expensive ration?
Well, as nutritionists, we're all taught to calculate rations based on least cost. So you look at, especially for ruminants, cattle and sheep, you can use a whole range of feedstuffs, whatever's available. And of course, when you're looking at it from an economic standpoint, you're trying to fulfill their nutrient requirements, but do it in the lowest cost possible.
So is the dominant feed right now, is it corn and soy?
Mm-hmm.
And that's
well,
why
and
we grow so much.
And distillers grains, which has come on strong in the last 10 years because there's an abundant supply of it. And it has a very large content of protein because of the yeast that has come out of the ethanol fermentation process.
And what grains are the distillers? There's still corn and corn?
Well, predominantly it's corn.
So it's just more corn?
Well, it's what's left of the corn. The starch is gone. Oftentimes plants are now separating the oil out because they're turning that into biodiesel.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so what's left is the corn kernel fiber and a whole lot of yeast bodies, you know, yeast biomass. So it's a lot of protein.
So is the yeast biomass a good thing or nutritionally not a good thing? Or is there just too much of it?
I think it's just a case we've got an awful lot of it to use.
Well, you talk about, what are those pumps?
Oh, efflux pumps.
Efflux pump inhibitors.
Well, efflux just means going out, mm-hmm. you know. So I try to use the comparison of a bilge pump in a ship where you're trying to get things out of the hold of a ship if water leaks in or whatever. And so in the last 10 years at least, microbiologists have been studying these things. There's all kinds of them in terms of different classes of efflux pumps in
different
species.
And this applies to cows and humans, right? We have efflux pump inhibitors in our...
Well, yeah. I mean, in the clinical world, people are trying to look for synthetic drugs that they can use to help control antibiotic resistance by blocking these pumps, because these bacteria use these pumps to get rid of nasty things that might harm them. So if an antibiotic is getting into their cell, they try and use the pump to pump it back out so it doesn't, before it does its damage. And so the rationale in the clinical world is to come up with effective drugs which will block these pumps, and then the bacteria can't repair itself or can't protect itself if its pumps are not operating. So it gets around the problem of antibiotic resistance in some
But in the meantime, you might be doing yourself some other disservice, right, with them?
Well, you know, with drug development, there's always the potential for side effects. So, you know, these things would have to be tested for toxicology, and they'd have to be tested with dose response for individuals and sensitive individuals. You know, that just comes with the development of any medicine for human use.
Well, because in the article you're saying that we need more of those to keep ourselves healthy.
Well, but the ones I'm talking about are naturally in the plant world.
Ah,
so in
big
all,
phrase, naturally in the plant world.
Yeah, as opposed to those that drug companies are trying to develop. I mean, they've looked at plants, too, as a first starter to give them some ideas mm-hmm. about maybe some compounds that they could synthesize specially that would be really potent. But that's a medicine. Here we're talking more nutrition and just what's out there in all kinds of plant. You know, think of any, you know, not just green. We put green in the title of this article, but, you know, think of your reds and your yellows and all kinds of things that show up in fruits and vegetables. So when we consume a diverse diet, not just potato chips or something, we get all kinds of compounds from the natural world in our diet. Now, you know, some of these things are known to be toxic, but we can tolerate certain doses. But others have these.
This is all used. The flavonoids are.
Yeah.
Are effects pump inhibitors?
Well, some of them. I mean, it depends. That's part of the research is that people are looking at different categories of natural plant compounds to see if they work. And it may depend on the species of microbe and the type of efflux pump that they have. Some work in some bugs and others don't work in those same bugs.
Which is why you need a variety, right?
Yeah, yeah. So if you have a variety, you're covering all bases.
Back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're talking to Mark Rasmussen today, talking about the food we eat and the food that the food we eat eats. We've been talking about efflux pump inhibitors, so stick around and find out some more.
What I'm trying to understand, Mark, is that the efflux pump inhibitors, which you write about, are somewhat lacking in what we're feeding animals today. And I would extrapolate that they may be lacking in our diets as well. Do you think this is a good summary of what you're talking about?
Yeah, that was basically the key message I was trying to get mm-hmm. across, that, you know, maybe there's too much technical detail in the first half of the article in trying to get up to that point.
No.
What we feed our chickens, what we feed our hogs is primarily corn, soy, plus other, you know, minerals, vitamins, and other supplement things to it. But because we have so much corn and soy in a state like Iowa, they are the cheapest and most available ingredients around. And animals do well on them. But there are unanticipated microbiological effects that we are learning about.
And what are those?
Well, for example, the USDA lab in Clay Center, Nebraska has studied the feeding of high levels of distiller's grains to cattle as being a contributing factor to the E. coli 0157 colonization in
Aha!
cattle.
That is a danger to human beings, for sure.
Well, which, yeah, been called, you know, the hamburger bug. you know, back from back in the 90s when it first started showing up in undercooked hamburger and harming individuals. And
so that's a result of what they've been having in that they've not had, you think, not quite enough greens, basically.
Well, I'm not saying it's the only factor. We don't know for sure where this...
Contributing factor.
It's a contributing factor, but it's what economics does to our livestock system when we push and push for high productivity at the lowest possible cost. When you think about it, I mean, the feedlot industry, on average, only makes $30 a head.
That's right.
You know,
that
it can be
food.
Minus $150 or it can be plus $150. Mm-hmm. But on average, if you average it out year to year to year, it's, you know, so when you think of a 1,000-head feedlot, you know, that's still not a whole lot of money.
No, I know.
And that's really the story in agriculture everywhere. The margins are not that large.
Well, and they're not going to the farmers, really.
Well, and that's what drives things to get bigger and more efficient and proceeding down paths that sometimes we don't think make the best sense from other standpoints. And well, in this case, alfalfa, when I've talked to some of the hog outfits, their first question is, well, what's the price of alfalfa meal? You know, it's a lot more than, you know, incorporating it in. And then there's been discussions about the logistics of their feed trucks and their feed distribution systems in barns and whether other kinds of ingredients would, you know, cause plugs and so the feed wouldn't flow as smoothly. So
basically feeding these animals what's a little bit skewed from their natural diet causes like the E. coli in beef. Do you think it also contributes to the MRSA or the avian flu, or we don't know? Or
well,
I mean, we're getting these major problems.
Viruses are a whole different world. This
well, but they are connected to immunity.
Well, yeah, immunity, but I don't know anything about if they even have efflux pumps. They're a much simpler organism than bacteria. So this doesn't, what I've written about doesn't apply to viruses. And I don't know about MRSA because MRSA is not really a gut, inside your gut, a kind of microbe. It's a surface.
What's a MRSA?
Oh, Staph aureus.
Ah, a staph.
It's multiply resistant Staph aureus. So Staphylococcus aureus is a skin microbe.
Right, and these are problems in the pork industry, right?
It shows up in pigs, but it shows up in humans from other sources too, and it can be a really nasty wound in humans if it gets going and can't be stopped. It can make, you know, people lose limbs, and they can have skin grafts and have, you know, all kinds of things. And so people have been looking at MRSA too, but I'm not saying anything in regards to that because I haven't seen. Although some of the efflux pumps have been studied in not in that MRSA strain, the MRSA strains, but in other staph bacteria. So we know they're there. We know they can be inhibited. So
But the basic thing is that the efflux pump inhibitors contribute to stronger intestinal better immunity.
We call it gut health.
Gut health.
Just
there
like
we go.
Soil health.
Just
gut health.
Just what
we
need. We all need gut health.
You know, it's immunity. It's happy bugs. It's the right bugs that keep you regular and keep you in good health. It's the right nutrition. It's the whole big picture view of what goes on inside of you.
And these efflux pump inhibitors come from naturally occurring compounds found in plants that we eat.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So if we and the animals that we eat also get more greens and kind of vegetable-y foods.
Well, and it's no different than what nutritionists have been advising people to do for decades, you know. Eat your vegetables, eat more fruits. I mean, I don't know what the latest is, but people are supposed to eat like 8 servings of vegetables and fruit a day, and maybe we eat 2. I think, you know.
I think the compliance rate to that is something like 10% of people eat the amount that is recommended.
Yeah.
I did recently read that 50% of all adult eating occasions are now officially snack food, which, unless you're eating an apple or a bunch of kale or some carrots, and that doesn't spring to my mind as mostly snack food. I think people are grabbing a yogurt or eating potato chips or.
Yeah, I wonder what they count as a snack food. You know, is it something you can eat one-handed while you're driving? Or,
yeah,
you know, what?
Or at the desk in front of me. But we are growing numbers of people are eating more and more snacks and less real food and meals. So perhaps we're just mirroring what our cattle are getting. They're just they're not getting that full course of breakfast, lunch, dinner. Oh, dear. Oh, dear. Oh, dear. So Mark recommends that, like your grandmother said, eat your vegetables.
And the smarter we are about our food, maybe we'll be a little healthier. At least think about that before we eat it.
Come back to the old thing, variety is the spice of life.
And yeah.
That certainly applies to what you eat.
Yeah. That was a discussion about cows and what cows eat, and we eat the cows, so it's kind of important. That was Mark Rasmussen from A Donalana Kitchen Show, August 2015, talking about the microbiome in cows and us, too. You're listening to KHOI 89.1. Find out more about the Donalana Kitchen at khoifm.org. We have archives. We have recipes back to school raspberry bars recipe will be up there soon. And we have, if you just can't get enough of us, you can go to the archives and listen to past shows. Yes, you can support this fine radio station. Welcome back. This is the Donalana Kitchen. Donna, you've got some news to share with us. What did you find out?
Oh, yeah, I got a little rant. I was reading Wired magazine this morning, and I saw this article, which I completely agree with it. It says, "The smart kitchen is very stupid." Connected cookbooks? Alexa-enabled microwaves? None of this stuff will make you a better home cook. I could not agree with it more. And then he goes on, because this writer, part of his job is testing these new gadgets and recommending them. He just says, the app-connected kitchen gadgets, the experimental tiny ovens, they failed. While our first whack at the connected home kitchen was interesting and occasionally even fun, for the most part, it has flopped like a souffle. And then he talks about, and this just makes sense, you know, it's like if you're, a lot of the gadgets are controlled by your app. Now, if you're in the middle of cooking with probably grease on your hands, are you going to want to open your smartphone, scroll through it, and hit the right buttons so that you can turn down the cooker? I don't think so. So he was complaining about a lot of them, you know, made these streamlined looking appliances, but they don't have knobs on them. So you can't just adjust them and regulate them. And and he also said that it's funny. He says the idea that you can make a home appliance smart and that you're done with making that, it had a lot of problems. He said it's hard enough to make a great appliance, and just adding an app to a basic one is not the answer. And then he also goes on and talks about how part of, you know, we have a large canon of cookbooks and knowledge about how to prepare things. So if you make a newfangled gadget and you have to learn a different way of cooking, most of these companies don't really invest. They'll make some, you know, quick little brochure about with 10 recipes or something like that, but they don't really take the time to make a full-fledged, well-tested, and you know how I feel about cookbook writing. It can be sleazy at worst and highly functional and very informative and helpful at best. But he was just saying that most of these companies that are manufacturing these clever ideas, appliances, are not thinking through, well, how do people really use it? And then there's not the backup body of knowledge to help people, nor would there be the motivation. You know, it's Wired in the Kitchen is not something that I think is going to be terribly successful.
I wouldn't think so either. Is the main function just turning things on and off? Is that kind of it? I mean, you still have to do all of the other prepare, chop, and get her ready, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I mean, we have had some successes. Like most ovens now have induction in them. So there's a fan added that actually makes the heating more even. There are changes in appliances that have improved them. But to think that you need an app that's going to turn on your slow cooker, although, you know, people do love their Instapots. Mm-hmm. I have to say, I haven't made that leap yet because it doesn't really suit my style of cooking. But I think it's a very good thing for people to be cautious before they buy a new piece of equipment. The latest is the hot air fryer.
Oh.
People love it. My daughter bought one. She loves it. I'm laughing. She goes, well, but, you know, she has a teenager so who likes everything fried. But the hot air fryer makes it taste like fried, but it's a lot less oil is involved. So there are some interesting uses for it. I did not go out and buy one. Uh-huh. But just think a lot of if you're really going to use it. If you're thinking of buying some gadget for your wife for Christmas, you better ask her if she really wants it. You know, I don't know. I was looking at some gadgets at our local cook store the other day, and they have a fancy new mixer that does all kinds of things. You know, I'm going, I think I'm going to stick with my good old KitchenAid.
Very good.
But anyway, smart kitchens. Some of it's very stupid. Don't waste your money. There
very
is
good.
That article in Wired if you want to take a look at it.
Good, good. Well, we've got some upcomings happening here.
Oh, we are busy around town.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yes. No, this is a ways out, but just to let you know, a Council of All Beings will be happening October 5th, and that is the Sierra Club.
The Iowa Sierra Club, yes.
Mm-hmm. Gathering at the Forage Camp south of Boone.
And I'm doing the cooking for that.
Oh, there you go.
There you go.
So go to the SierraClub.org/Iowa to find out. And there'll be masks. And
that's
and
October 5th.
Yeah, October 5th. And the Central Iowa Barn Dance is coming up this weekend. So come and dance.
Are you calling on
I am calling
oh,
that
boy,
one.
Oh, boy.
You can. We have a Facebook, Central Iowa Barn Dance Association. You can find out more at that site.
And our talented dance caller, Lana, is also an artist. Tell her what else you're doing.
Get this.
What else
get
you're doing
this okay?
week.
I might go to this just to find out what's going to happen. Okay. Art Talk at the Octagon Center with Lana. Huh? Thursday, September 26th, 6 to 8. The Octagon Center is right across the street here from the station
on Douglas.
And
so you're going to talk about your art-making process. And, of course, I'm hoping some of your work will be on display.
Yeah, it will. It will. I am the, get this, I'm the featured artist for September. Meet Lana Nachtigal, artist, farmer, entrepreneur, dancer, radio personality at KHOI Community Radio. Punster and environmentalist. Her cards and prints have been bringing smile to people for years. Learn where she gets her inspiration. It's fun. So just show up. I'll be talking about lots of things. I mean, I've been in this town for a while.
I just can't get quite enough of Lana Nachtigal.
It's an art thing. Go to the Octagon Thursday, September 26th, 6 to 8 p.m. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We are here Tuesday at noon, repeated 7 p.m. You can listen anytime. Go to khoifm.org. And support this radio station. If we're in your ears, put us in your heart and punch that donate button. This is Community Radio. We'll go out with the music of Alex Mitchell and Liz Donaldson, the East Tennessee Blues. My name's Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Brzgintas.
And we've had excellent engineering by Cynthia McClure. We always have a good time here. Eat good food and enjoy life.